back to Decades on Dirt Roads. This is Maddie.
And this is Catherine. And today we're welcoming Mark Chachos. Where to begin with Mark? He's really done it all. His family immigrated from Greece, came through Ellis Island, and ever since then they've been in Northeast Oregon logging. He started his own logging business back in the day. And has really been a huge part of this landscape. He's really managed for intent and really grown his business, and he shares his opinions on
everything.
Everything.
Select all.
But you know how to hustle and how to make it work, and really how he got going. He shares stories on running Dozer and fighting fire. From the Umatilla to out in Hell's Canyon, and he's got some crazy stories, so we'll keep this short because his episode's pretty long, but you have anything to add?
No, enjoy. We had a lot of fun talking to this guy. Learned a lot of things, and boy, he's a storyteller, so please enjoy.
My name's Mark Chachos. 72, I'll be 73 here in a month. Born and raised here in the Grand Ronde Valley, actually west of La Grande at Starkey on a family ranch. You know, and I see your first question here was, how did your family get to Eastern Oregon? And well, that's, my dad was a Greek immigrant. He came through Ellis Island in 1912. I had the privilege of about 5 years ago going to New York City, and I went to Ellis Island and got all the information.
Got to see his name on the sign-in sheet.
Everything. I've got it all upstairs. I've got a picture of the boat he came on in the manifest. And he came with 13 other Greek men to America, and four or five of them were the same mountain village.
Oh, wow.
In fact, that picture there is one of the houses in the village.
Wow.
Did he come with his family or just
himself? No, he was 16 years old.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And he came here, and he had to be sponsored. And, you know, back then, if you came and were in ill health, you know, they'd turn you around and send you back or whatever. And you had to have a sponsor. He had $5 in his pocket. And he had a cousin who lived in Portland. Mm-hmm. And so he went to all these Greek men. They all went to Portland, and they heard of work at Bridal Veil Falls, which is just up from Multnomah Falls. Mm-hmm. There's a sawmill there, and they went to work. And from there, they heard of work in Wallowa County in Camp 10. It's on Hancock property.
Yeah.
And they went up there. And then the Norgard Trestle, have you ever seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he worked on that.
That is cool.
And then he met my mom's dad out there. He was working out there. Mm-hmm. And you're from Eastern, and from my mom's side of the family, my granddad lived where Hoke Hall is now.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Like the house in between the baseball field and football field.
Oh, yeah.
That's my cousin's.
Wow.
And he owned a lot of the property around there. And when I was a little kid, I spent a lot of time there. And he was from Yugoslavia. But anyway, my dad, through Joe Thomas, met my mom, Matilda, and they got married. And they then from Camp 10, they heard of work in where Camp Elkanah is now.
Yeah.
It used to be Mount Emily Lumber Company.
Oh, yeah.
And he went to work there, and he was a section foreman. They laid all the steel all over, and he was a section foreman and laid all the steel to log these, you know, back then.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1925. I got the manifest of that upstairs. He was the fifth person hired by Mount Emily Lumber Company. Mike Moorhead, you know?
Yeah, I love Mike.
His granddad was the boss at Mount Emily Lumber Company.
Wow.
That's crazy, because I did all of our, like, deeds and easements last winter when I had knee surgery. And so I went through all that stuff and saw all of the transition from Mount Emily Lumber when Boise was back up buying all that stuff. And so it was really cool to see all the stuff that we used to own up around Starkey and Ukiah and Elkanah and stuff.
Yeah, it's quite. So my dad went there, and the Greek men followed, and he was one of the only ones that ever married.
Really?
And my mom married a bunch of Greek men. They all lived with our family.
Yeah.
And I was an afterthought. I got a brother that's 91 and a sister who's just going to turn 30 at the end of the month, or 90 at the end of the month. On
that's
the 30th.
A big difference. Wow.
Yeah, on the 30th of March, she's going to turn 90.
Wow.
And then we lost a sister, and she'd have been 88, and then I got a brother that's 82.
Mm. Big family.
And then me, and I'm 72. And anyway, so they moved there, and they bought a ranch, and my brother Bill lives on it to this day. And when I was little, we lived on 3rd Street up here, and the Greek men were old, and there was 4 of them left. My dad had died when I was 7 of a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they were old, and my dad, when I was just a little kid, you know, he wouldn't let them speak Greek. He says, we're Americans now. And that's the biggest regret I ever had, because I'm going to Greece for the 12th time
mm-hmm.
in July this year.
Wow.
And I don't speak it. I know words, but I don't speak it to carry on a conversation.
That's so sad. That's a,
yeah,
that's
it is. A, I bet he became Americanized, you know, and we're in America now. So, you know, we were there, and like I said, that's how we ended up in Eastern Oregon.
Wow. Never left. It's a good spot to be.
That's a great spot.
Yeah.
You know, I had a ranch in Wallowa County for 9 years.
So is that before logging?
No, while I was logging.
Yeah.
I bought it in 1976, I believe. And then I met Sarah, lived in Wallowa, and then we sold, and I really got into the logging full. I was logged all the time.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway, that's how we got here. That was one question you'd asked. And I'll kind of look here and talk about what I did as a logger. The only one in our family that really ever logged, my oldest brother cut logs in the 50s and 60s.
Here?
Well, here, Grants Pass.
Kind of all over.
But mainly here. And when I was in my teens, I'd go to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to run a power saw. I don't know why. That and heavy equipment.
There's a drive for that, I think, a lot
of people.
Well,
the whole thing it is, it's a mentality thing
mm-hmm.
to be a logger. And when I lived at Wallowa, before my mom lived with me, before I got married,
mm-hmm.
and we took in a kid from a family in Vancouver, and he lived with us and went to high school through a mutual friend. That's how I met him. And he started logging and cut logs, and he's a big, huge physical man, and he can hardly walk today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a man, he's in 58 or 9.
Wow.
And he's got a son that's, son goes out with Stormy, and I'm trying to talk him out of it. He's like 6'4" and Hollywood good looks. And he's cutting logs because his dad did. Anyway, you know, to get back to my own story, I was born on a cattle ranch and mm-hmm. farmed, but I liked machinery and I liked running a power saw. Well, I graduated high school in June 2nd of 1969. And on June 3rd at 4 o'clock in the morning, I went working in the woods.
Mm.
Been there ever since. I started out as a knot bumper, pulled line on an old SJ4 line machine.
Mm-hmm.
And done that for a couple summers. I went to Oregon State University. I'd done that for a couple summers. And then I went cutting logs for Hafer Brothers Logging. Yeah, I started cutting for them in 1973.
Yeah, because I've heard it changed a lot around that time.
Yeah, it was all power saw.
Mm-hmm.
There was no mechanical at all. But it was big wood. We were out north of Elgin. They were just opening that up out over Lookout Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know. I mean, their foresters putting up timber sales. They had the jack sale, and it was, I think it was 44 million cat logging and 22 million line logging.
Wow. Virgin. They don't put up those numbers.
No, that just virgin timber, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we cut out there. And so I cut logs for Hafer Brothers, and then I bought a ranch in Wallowa and moved there. And a guy that I cut logs with started his own logging outfit, Charlie. And so I was there, and I I bought a D6 skid cat, and I started skidding and cutting for Charlie. Mm-hmm. And then things went kind of south there after a while. So we split up, and they took that, and I went to Joker's with my nephew. We started with a two-wheel drive Dodge pickup and three or four wore-out power saws and a D5 cat. And then a friend of mine, Craig Bryce's dad, helped me get financing, and I bought a log loader. And my nephew and me worked, and everything was by hand, and we put four loads out every day.
That's impressive.
Every day.
How big was, like, acres-wise, was that saying?
Joke place was 3,800 acres. It's at Starkey there.
Yeah.
And then from there, that was 85, and that's right when the price started going up. Price of bullpine was $125 delivered. Doug fir was $140 delivered, period. Yellow pine, a few bucks more. That was it. White fir was 120 maybe.
Down to the mill here. You're taking
Elgin or LeGrand. Yeah. Pine went to LeGrand. Well, I bought Joe timber on a 5-year contract based on those prices. Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden the prices was, Doug fir was 240, bull pine was 200. Well, I was making money.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when my business expanded. Well, I had no contractual obligation to pay him more money, but I gave him, I don't know, $5 or $8 more a thousand, because I looked across the fence and his cousins had 10,000 more acres of timber.
Dang.
So that worked out, and I got that. And so from there, my business started growing. That's how I got my own company started.
Yeah.
I started in 1985, and we started going. And we just kept producing and producing and hard, you know. It was hard work.
Like, oh, yeah.
When we had that, was my nephew and me at Joe Coos wintertime. It was one of them bad winters. Coming down the river in the dark, we had a big pitch stump fire. You know, we'd be soaking wet from sweat and mm-hmm. snow. And we didn't have a heater in the pickup, so we'd have to roll the windows down to get to town.
Dang.
You know. And, I mean, that stories are all the same. That's just like Hafer back to him, mm-hmm. what he built, him and to make sure there was a load of logs when the truck got here. You know, I mean, this, like I said, it's a whole different ball game today than what it was then. You know, and we were the same way. I mean, I was driven. Mm-hmm. I had some financial problems, and we worked through that and got going in the right direction, you know, and my nephew and me just worked. And I worked 7 days a week. Right. I'd go cut on the weekends, and then I'd skid. My nephew ran the loader and bump knots, and I'd help him, or I'd mm-hmm. cut, you know, but we were working all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And anyway, we got started and rolling. We got going on to the Cooner property. And so from there, I never really worked for a mill like most people do, mm-hmm. like for Hancock.
Yeah.
I managed ranch property. At one time, I had about 40,000 acres under contract, you know. And we were the full mill deal. We catalogued, we line logged. BTO done a lot of work for us. But I had a line machine. And we were the first people, well, the first operator to bring in a single grip into Eastern Oregon. Mm. And then BTO was working on a big ranch. I'll get to that in a minute. I'm getting ahead of myself.
You're getting excited.
We'll back up.
You're getting excited.
And one of Joe's cousins was Shirley Cooner. Well, her husband Dixon's a big cattle rancher. And I started logging on his property. And one day he finally says, I've got a chance to buy this ranch, but I don't have any money. And so we went and looked at it, and we got up. We were on this high point, and it's up Ladd Canyon here. Well, we went up Ladd Canyon at that time to access it, but it's between here and Starkey. And he looked, and it was just all this timber. And he said, I can't pay for it. And I says, Dick, before you go to sleep tonight, make sure you got an earnest money agreement with me. Hmm. You have to have that tonight. He said, I'll get you the money. Hmm. And he was having some financial problems. His own, the bank was wanting to sell cows. I mean, he was interested strictly in cows.
Yeah.
And so for me giving Joe a little extra money that I wasn't obligated, I got to Dick knowing I'd done a good job with him. And anyway, he got this ranch, and it was 12,000 acres.
Wow.
Your money's right here.
I swung the deal. I just went to the mills and says, look, what are you going to give me? You know, and these stories can just keep going on and on. Like, I was still growing at that time. We needed a big dozer to build road. I knew what I wanted. I wanted a D7F with a U-blade and a ripper on it. and we shopped all over. I drove by Peacock Mill at Al Sal right out here. It isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And here this dozer sat. And I pull in here and I go, Bill, who's... He says, Richard Dodge has the mill over it. It was Richard Dodge's dozer. He comes out and he goes, what do you got going? And I said, well, a client of mine just bought a big ranch. He says, got any pulp on it? That's when he was very first starting his pulp down
that
there.
That mill?
At Boardman.
Yeah.
And I says, oh yeah, that's what we're going to log. He says, well, let's go look at it. Didn't know this guy from that. Drove up there, made a deal that night, shook hands. And I go, well, I got to talk it over with Dick. He says, I'll give you X amount of dollars for the pulp, and $2 of it goes payment of the cat. And he told me what the price for the cat was. Mm-hmm. Until the cat's paid off, it'll be $2 come out of that. I said, well, I got to talk to Dick before I do anything. So I called up Dick, and it was way better than any other pulp price in the country, even with the haul. And so shook his hand. Next morning, I had Bowman out there and hauled a dozer up there.
Wheeling and dealing.
And that was just how fast things transgress back then.
Yeah.
And so that got me started, and from there I just kept growing, and I spent a month there and drew a plan of how we were going to log it, you know. Mm-hmm. We had to clean up some mess he had pine logs decked that we hauled in and got a good price for and everything. And
dry blued pine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we started building the road, and that's another story. We had two little daughters, and we took the cat in Ladd Canyon. We had to go. Well, there's no road, but where I wanted to get, there was a Jeep trail. And you went down this way, and then you backed down this way, and then went this way, and backed down this way. And it was not that good a road. And she was there with our two little girls following me in to get going, because we needed that road opened up so we could start getting logs out of there, because we were bringing them out through Ladd Canyon, and the Forest Service was just hosing us on the haul rate.
Dang.
I think it was like $16 or $18 a thousand they were charging us back then. And that was in 93, I think.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. But, we got a good price, and then just things, We logged some pine out of there, but we sold down John Day for $1,010 a thousand.
Holy cow.
The most we got out of fir was $780 while we were on that ranch, Doug Fir.
Wait, did you say pine was getting a...
$1,010 a thousand in John Day, yellow pine. This was in the early 90s, mid 90s. You know what we got for pulp?
What?
From Dodge when it hit a peak there?
Yeah.
$78 a ton. All we were logging was pulp. We logged over 5,000 loads of pulp off that ranch.
That is insane.
Yeah. Things just went rolling. Making nothing but money.
Yeah, I would imagine.
The agreement with Dick was to swing the deal to get it and everything, that I owned a percentage of the timber.
Mm.
So it worked out well for both of us. Got him out of financial trouble, and he grew from there. He bought a lot of property that he'd rented. It just worked out for everybody. But from there, I just started picking up most of the private pieces of property between there and the elk fence that I didn't. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Dick bordered her, and Dick's known her all over, he was well established in Echo. That was her home base for their ranch.
Oh, okay.
And then had summer range here. Well, there was a fence, but about 400 yards up through Elk Mountain, through a thicket, there was never a fence. Well, they surveyed that, and the fence was here and the surveyed line was here. Well, Dick had a fence built one spring on the surveyed line.
Oh, the survey stressed me out.
Well, I got a lot of story about that.
Oh,
trust
no.
me. I've got eons because, see, I not only logged, I done it all.
Yeah.
I put things together and made, so I got all the ends of everything. Anyway, I got a letter. Dick called me up and he says, you get a letter for Ronnie? And I go, oh yeah, I got a letter for Ronnie.
She's a little hot right now.
She had a fence crew come in and tear that brand new fence out and move it over and build a new fence on the old fence line.
That's bold.
And Dick's lawyer says, whatever you do, leave her alone. Just let her do whatever. It was three sisters. He owned all that whole basin in there. And he had three daughters and he split it up for them daughters. And,
so if you mess with one line, it was going down there.
Yeah, but anyway, this is years past.
Yeah.
This is from a long time ago, from the early 1900s. And he had three daughters, and then they passed it on to the next generation. Gotcha. And Ronnie's just basically a trust fund baby. You know, well, I mean, honestly.
Never
done anything. She's just looking for a scrap. Well, her mom remarried, and they fought for 5 years. She tried getting his ranch because his mom was, and it had been in the family for over 100 years at that time. You know, and the lawyer, the dickhead, was a lawyer for O'Brien. He just says, just leave her alone. One day I got a call. It was Ronnie. She says, you know, I've had you checked out. My wife's wearing the right amount of the yellow legal pad. Hang up. Don't say anything. She's crazy. She's going on there. And she goes, I've had you checked out, and you were first in four of the five things I want. She says, I want you to come look at my property to log it. Well, it's never been logged yet. You know, I mean, it's just, you can't deal with her at all. You know. You know, that. But landline issues, I started, I done one up above the Red Barn at Cove.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I think, five. My wife threw all my maps away. That just, I had all kinds of stuff. She's that, you're done. You don't need it anymore. But I had these maps, and there was five landowners, and it was on a correction line. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what section line that is, but it goes all the way through Starkey. It come right through the middle of all this.
Yeah.
Like Dix and all that was a correction line through there. So you know how that worked. This Esther, I'll never forget. She's like an 80-year-old lady, and I logged all of them down through there. And at the courthouse, she was 40 acres.
Mm-hmm.
She was like 18.23 acres. She says, you mean all these years I've been paying tax on 40 acres?
Oh, no.
18 acres, you know? And that was that correction line.
Yeah.
You know, so that was my first dose of really getting involved with landline issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I testified in court, sued. We were up for a felony. In, I don't know, about 17 or 18 years ago, I tried to block it out of my mind. Ooh. But Dick called me, and his son-in-law was head of the Oregon State Police at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at a bull sale in Twin Falls, Idaho, and coming home. And his son-in-law called me, and he goes, Dick, I just come across the wire. You and Mark are up for felonies. He says, as soon as you get into Oregon, you turn yourself into the sheriff, and you better call Mark up and tell him, to turn yourself in. So I turned myself in, and it was my nephew that fingerprinted and mugshot me.
The one that you were cutting with? All that?
No.
Different one.
We're a big family. And anyway, you know, and it was just a bogus charge over a landline deal. I probably wasn't the best business person in the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I liked money, but I didn't like it enough to cheat, rob, or steal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity, and I passed up a lot of those kind of deals.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of them, I was working at Lincoln Mountain, and right there across from the toll gate chalet, there was 40 acres of beautiful timber. Well, Richard bought it and clear cut it. He wasn't a very big fan after that, trying to buy timber in that area. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I was a small, independent guy. I had nobody representing me, but I never advertised, and I never ran out of work.
Just word of mouth, good.
Word of mouth, and I had these places under contract, you know, and as we done it, we turned it into a full meal deal. We built stock ponds to bring cattle off of creeks.
Mm-hmm.
We relocated roads that were on creeks. We built bridges.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't just come in, we're going to log it and leave like a lot of the guys did.
Mm-hmm.
We managed it for years. We managed it for the long haul. With Dick, everywhere we logged, we grass seeded the next spring with a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
5-seed mix.
Yeah, because he probably wanted more rangeland, not more trees.
Yeah, he was a cowman.
Yeah.
He had cows. He wanted more, but we always had the timber. I remember there in the later stages, we were there about 16 years, and we were logging, and we had some pretty nice logs decked up. Where'd these come from? Is it because we didn't have to log them the first time, Dick? We were selling pulp for $78. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I called myself a bottom-end logger. Yeah? Did I do clear cuts, and did I cut good trees? I can't deny it.
Yeah.
I did. But on these ranches, I tried selling the crappiest timber at the best price I could get out of it. I was merchandising.
Yeah, you did just enough to get what they needed. And that's, I mean, you were just managing the property.
Yeah,
and
for future. Yeah. Not today and make a quick buck. You know, that was like back there when Boise was doing that. That's what I said. You know, there was guys going in buying 40 acres and wiping it out. Oh, we made $10,000. Boy, we're smart. You know, $10,000 was a lot of money, but it was nothing. I mean, it could have busted my business. you know, a lot of people frowned on that. So I never did do that. I never bought up, let other people do it.
Yeah.
We'd log it. You know.
Well, you had those big enough properties. You could just then pick through it slowly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, we went over Dick's ranch three times. First time was straight pulp.
Yeah.
So all we logged was dead fir about this big around. And it all went on a long log truck, if you can believe that. We never had a short logger in there. And mm-hmm. It was almost, you ought to have seen some of the loads. They were pretty ratty. You know, I mean,
probably we had logs weigh stitching much,
them.
Though.
Well, we'd have one and then two like this. And
sure the mills loved you.
They didn't.
You know, double ending stuff.
Oh, and triple ending. And, you know, we were cutting for scale. Yeah. We weren't after production. Mm-hmm. We produced,
yeah.
But we were after scale, yeah. You know. And so back to, I cut first, and then I worked in Wallowa County, and then I went and started my own. But, you know, I cut logs in the Oregon Cascades in big timber. I had a friend that we'd done a huge job in Estacada. In fact, I had some pictures up there. I let a guy cut an old growth that Jerry from Baker. Me and him logged a friend of mine's aunt. It was on the South Abiqua River, and they were going to move the RMA from 100 to 400 feet. Mm-hmm. And they did give them plenty of notice to log if they wanted to. His aunt was old enough. One side was 72 years old, logged, planted, and the other side was 68. Mm-hmm. I think it averaged about 38,000 of the acre. And we cut it to the 100. But mm-hmm. It was really weird. There was a tree this big that fell out of the RMA. We had to cut it off the 100 feet. We couldn't chase it to the butt. It was just, you know, I still can't understand that. Anyway, we logged a lot of big timber and we logged a lot of small timber. I did a lot of pre-commercial thinning. We cut it all by hand, so we really selected the trees. And then I piled it all with a log loader and then skidded it out with a skidder. And we tried to chip as much of it as we could and merchandise even that crap wood.
Yeah, definitely making the most out of everything.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what I done. I done it for 50 years. And it was a great life, you know, but a hard life. You know, I'm pretty crippled myself, you know, from down there to up here. You know, ruptured both my Achilles tendons, 12 knee operations.
12?
This is my second artificial knee, and as soon as I get back from Greece, this will be my second artificial knee.
Wow.
Broke my back twice, had neck surgery, both my shoulders replaced. Cut this arm half off right here. When I was cutting we were at what they called Morgan's Clear Cut, going over Lookout Mountain. That's probably ancient history by now. It's all grown up. That was in the early 70s. It was huge timber, huge. Mm-hmm. You know, 5, 6, 7 foot on the stump. And there was a big white pine there, and Dave had come down, and we'd all been knifing them. They're calling it a yum unit. And they're cutting these huge white fir coals. And they had to yum it all up. They had these massive piles and very little merchantable wood and left all these white pine and yellow pine stand. And my cutting partner, after I quit, he said they went back in there about 5 years later because most of it blew over or broke off.
Aww.
Beautiful wood. But anyway, it was about a 6 foot white pine, and it had a vine maple about that big around growing. I had my fallen saw with my long bar on it, McCullough 125 anyway, that's in a 48 inch bar, and you know, weighed I think 37.5 pounds full of gas and oil. Yeah. I had it up here and that thing sprung, and it was going to come down on me, and I just stuck my arm, and all it did was hit it and go off, and it cut this muscle here in two, and all I can remember, it was just like five worms spitting blood out at me. And I cut one bone, and I just grabbed it like that, and I walked around the hill to my cutting partner, and I go, cut my arm pretty bad, and thank God it was downhill to the pickups instead of uphill.
Yeah.
He said, well, I'll go get this Charlie. And so I got down there, and Charlie had it ready, and he put a couple gauze bandages, 4x4s, and then took his t-shirt and wrapped it, and Mike brought me to town. It never hurt until we got to Peacock Mill, and then like that, it was just like you're wringing my shoulder out of the socket.
Oh.
It hurt, oh, so bad. And I walked into the hospital up here, and I knew Karen Ritter was the nurse, and I go, Karen, I need a shot. And she goes, Mark, I can't do that. I got to look at it. I said, you don't want to look at it. I said, cut my arm half off. I need a pain medicine.
Yeah.
And She took that off and just filled her face with blood. Just, and I grabbed it again like that. She's, oh my. And I, yeah.
I told you.
Brad, since he might have been before your time here, he was an orthopedic surgeon. Mm-hmm. He went to Harvard and Dartmouth, and we became real good friends with that. But he'd just come here, and he ended up being an orthopedic surgeon for the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
Gave him a lot of business, though.
Huh?
You gave him a lot of business.
Well, you know, I was very lucky. There was Ken, Dr. Stevens, and Dr. Densmore, and now Dr. Olson,
mm-hmm.
all very, very good surgeons.
Yeah, we're pretty lucky with that.
I mean, in this area, we're really lucky. You know, Greg was Stanford educated.
Right.
You know, some people said, well, he had a bad bedside manner. And I said, I don't care as long as he'd done the job right.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And he done a lot of work on it. But anyway, Dr. Stevens come out of surgery, and he poked around, and he looked like a young Rowdy Yates. He's only like, Clint Eastwood there. And he looked just like that. He had a gauze seat, and he'd dab and pinch one off, and finally got him pinched off. And they just gave me a shot and put me out in the hall in the gurney. They didn't have room for me, and Dr. German operated on me that night about 7 o'clock.
Oh, my gosh.
This is like 10 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, man. So this is a shout-out to the doctors.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they were just, you know, I cut this knuckle here. I'm left-handed, and that's what created a lot of that. A power saw is not left-handed friendly.
No.
They're designed for a right-handed person. And I've got, I don't know how many stitches up and down my legs.
Scarpalooza.
Just throwing the chain.
Yeah.
First year my wife and me were married, we were working out on James Ridge out east of Joseph, mm-hmm. between the Imnaha and Sheep Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And I threw my chain right here. Man, it just bleeped. Didn't even cut it. It just tooth hooked.
You don't have chaps yet?
I never wore them. Never
Your
did.
Wife must be a saint. I'm going to say that right now.
And anyway, so I go, God. She's, well, I says, I cut myself. She says, how? It didn't even tear your pants. About that time, blood just come running down my leg. So we went into Enterprise, and I had, I think it was 7 stitches right there. It dug it pretty good.
And you must have.
She hit the floor. She couldn't stand. That's first year we were married. She's had to put up with a lot. I've had a pretty...
You've tested her.
I've had a pretty colorful career.
That is a perfect phrase.
Huh?
A colorful career.
Had a pretty colorful career. Most people, you know, like we went to Vegas and we were at the Penningtons one time down there. We were downtown and I had, you know, I dress casual. I wear Birkenstocks and shorts and a mm-hmm. t-shirt when I'm not working, you know. If I never wear another pair of boots, I'll be a happy man, you know. And we were there one day and this guy goes, what are you, a lawyer or a judge or something? Because I had white hair, you know. Yeah, that's what I am.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like to know?
Yeah, I'd like been a lawyer a few times. But, you know, and then I sidelined out from that. I had big dozers.
Mm-hmm.
Had a D8 and a D7, and I did a lot of dozer work for Mike Pony and Mike.
Do you get wrapped into fire with those
dozers?
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sure you got a good story about that, the way your face looks right
oh,
now.
Oh, yeah. Do you know Tony? He's from Baker.
Describe him more.
He's a contractor that runs a dozer.
Does he still do it?
He logged. He come from a logging family.
Oh, okay.
Is he
related to Rocky?
That's his cousin. They're all related. His dad was a big time logger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like 50 load a day logger. But I mean, he had no mercy on the ground. I mean, like when was logging down at Fossil,
mm-hmm.
or it was Boise Cascade then,
yeah.
I guess, in the 90s.
I've heard about that.
Nobody'd be working. Leroy would be working.
I just
and
know,
I mean,
I met
be mud
Rocky.
Running down the road and run over. If there was a tree left, he ran over it.
That is in their DNA, because Rocky cleaning up a job, those are not water bars, those are tank traps, and good freaking luck closing that.
Yeah. But Tony is a very good operator.
Dozer. Yeah, they're all good operators.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah. Tony's
they're
a very...
a little extreme would be the right way
oh,
to
yeah.
put it.
Oh, yeah. Like Leroy used to be out there at the Polk Farm when they had the plantation there at Boardman.
Mm-hmm.
He done work there, and he loaded with a 966. And if he had 3 wheels on the ground, Is it that was too many.
Too many.
He's in a walking OSHA violation.
Oh, I mean, they're just wild. But anyway, Tony was a very good dozer operator, and we're not, you know, social friends, but we were on a lot of fire together, mm-hmm. and we showed people what to do.
Yeah.
We were on a fire at Unity, and it was the only fire that year in the country. And so they had a type 1 team in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing didn't even want to burn.
But you were there.
We were there, and they had more iron there than you can shake a stick at. They had, on another side, they had Iron Triangle, and all these guys from Triangle, they had like 30 pieces of logging equipment.
Whoa.
And they were logging dead lodge pole and decking it. Instead of putting the fire out. We were on the east side. It was just Tony and me. And I had my 8 and Tony had his Hi-Track 7. And they go there, and the first thing they said, we built some fire line, and the fire line was 60 feet wide, and you could drive a Cadillac down it. Tony would lead, and then I'd polish up behind him and stump everything and right. get everything. I mean, it was smooth as silk. They had it out.
It was a highway.
It was a highway, and they wanted a safety zone this one day. Tony's got the pictures, and he never did get them forwarded to me. And, you know, I got volumes of pictures up there of what we'd done, you know, logging and everything mm-hmm. over the years. And anyway, they wanted this 5-acre clear cut. I mean, a safety zone. Mm-hmm. It was old timber about this big around and pretty thick stand. Well, we, on our way back, we'd push trees over. And if we couldn't push them right over, we'd take a ripper and cut a root or two and push them right over. And then we'd get together and we'd just start rolling it like a big ball. Mm-hmm. And we'd have a ball bigger than this house and roll it down there to the far end. And we had trees just gargantuan. And then when we finished, we'd go dozer to dozer and just smooth it out and make a parking lot. You know, but we'd done that a lot. Done it Chicken Hill, all over. But that fire there, they wouldn't put it out. It was kind of an overcast gray day, and we were clear up and ready to hook it around into where those guys were logging dead lodge pole, yeah. basically on the government dime. And Tony, we were there the morning meeting, and Tony goes, why don't you let Chachi and me just whip this around there, and we're done. We got this fire corralled. No, can't do it. And he says, what do you mean we can't do it? Oh, it's pretty tough terrain. He says, have you been seeing what we've been doing lately?
Unsupervised for the last, I don't know how many days.
That's right.
Yeah,
they exactly. moved this two ridges over
right.
through 20-year-old timber that had burnt, and they'd planted a beautiful stand of timber coming. Mm-hmm. And we built, I don't know, 7 to 11 miles of fire line and 3 5-acre safety zones, 60 feet wide.
Guys put in some work.
And they were trying to backburn into it, and they couldn't make it backburn into where we'd already put the fire out. And finally, I had enough of the division soup. I'm pretty independent. And I just go, you know, send me home.
Yeah.
I'm
done here.
Yeah. I mean, this is ridiculous. We all know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're just milking the cow, mm-hmm. you know. And I says, I don't do that. Mm-hmm. He says, you're going to let this good money go? I go, I can make more money a day at home with this cat than I am here. And I can sleep next to my wife and eat her food instead yeah. of this crap here. You know, and
yeah.
it's true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. like Mike and me were the only two that had D8s on there, and Gary Blue, who was head of the Region 6, says, you guys are charging too much money. I says, how many D8s have you ever owned, Gary? You know, how can you tell us what the rate is?
Yeah.
You know, because I charged a little more than everybody else, but I figured my skill level was a little bit better than most people that ran a D8. And I charged at that time $250 an hour, and I had 5 pretty good sized ponds to build mm-hmm. and some other work that I was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, why be on a fire
right.
where I'd make less money?
Right.
And work, you know, we were working long hours and working. We were working them dozers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, anyway, another story with Tony, the Cache Creek fire a few years ago. Is that before your time mm-hmm. on the Snake River? Mm-hmm. I was the most expensive cat, and Tony was a few dollars under me. We were 15 and 16. There were 16 dozers in this region, and we were the last two to be called. Well, they had the Cache Creek fire, and I was on standby out here for the feds. Woody and Brenda, who used, she was in charge of that fire up there. Mm-hmm. Tony, and Woody goes, Chacha's right here. And Tony's and Baker, send them up there. They had 8 dozers up there, and they couldn't do nothing. Well, we get it there, and I didn't know Tony was coming, and I just parked at Buckhorn Lookout. And I no more set my air brakes, and here come Tony. And he just had his little John Deere 650, and I had my High Track 5 Skid Cat. Well, they go, we're going, and we went clear to Eureka Bar on the Snake River. Eureka Bar is where the Salmon River comes into the Snake River. And we went from the top of that night. We left about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we went down there and got out about 4 o'clock the next morning. And I mean, that wasn't flat ground.
No, it's not.
And anyway, this one spot, Tony went through it first, and he kicked it. And he couldn't. It was on an old wagon trail, and we couldn't improve anything, because it was historic, but we could clean it off. Right. And it was just a sheer rock wall like this. And Tony went first, and I was second. And there was stuff in the road, so I had to have my dozer, angle dozer, this way to mm-hmm. kick it over. If I could have went this way, I'd have had enough room to crowd into the bank a little more. But I had about that much of my track hanging off the road. And I mean, it was literally as steep as that fireplace, and I said 1,000 feet. Tony says, "Hell, Chachi, that's 2,000 with nothing there." You know, and I mean, I done the cardinal sin. I got about halfway through, and I looked over.
No.
And I got I got shake legged like you couldn't believe. I mean, I just stop that. You know, let's quit now. You know,
we gotta finish.
And
we've got work to do.
And you know, took me about an hour to go about 100 yards. Here's Tony eating a tuna fish sandwich. Yeah. I'm Chachi. And I go, "You son of a guy." You know, I says, "This is a bunch of bull." And I told y'all, I go, "Brenda, I'm going over the top going back. I will not go on that road in the dark." And then we went down farther, and there was a place like this, and there's a bunch of rocks piled here, and they wouldn't let us open that up much because it was historic.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a heck of a time getting through there. I was quite a bit bigger dozer than Tony's. And anyway, we went down and got to Eureka Bar that night. We're headed out at dark, and this is a government deal here. We had 3 dozer bosses apiece. 1 state, 1 feds, 1 BLM. As a tri-deal fire.
Hmm.
Well, most of them were fatter than me. And, you know, out of shape. And it
so
was
basically long. Trying to get back up.
Yeah. Tony goes, "Why don't you guys hang your packs on my ripper and hop on with Chachi?" I had 3 guys sitting on my cat in there. And this one guy, he was probably ready to retire. He was from Portland,
mm-hmm.
the office there.
Yeah.
And he just coming to make some quick money, you know. And he was humped up there in the corner on this side here. And I says, "Do not touch anything and don't say anything."
These are my rules.
Don't do it. And so we start heading out of there. It's dark. One of them, you know, black nights like this, you can't see your hand in front of your face. And we got to that spot and my lights went out. I blew a fuse. I mean, we were right in the middle of that procedure, and I have to turn my blade and then back up and drop my grapple a little bit and everything to get jacked around there. And this one guy, this Jerry, he's a botanist for the feds up in Wallowa County.
Mm-hmm.
Tony and me had educated him on a few fires earlier, so he kind of knew, you know. Man, his headlight was off, and he was checking stuff, and yeah. Tony was out in front, and I says, "Don't touch nothing." I says, "That guy over here happened to hit that grapple lever and flip it, we'd have been in the bottom. You know, I mean, it just jerked us right over the edge and we'd have been gone." And I screwed around there a minute. Finally, Tony backed up and got some light, and we screwed around and couldn't get the lights to work right then. And I says, "Well, let me jockey this around." And I got it around and we got, and anyway, we went up. And then the fire jumped that one steep part. What I was telling about when I had a hard time coming through because mm-hmm. I was too wide.
Yeah.
So we had to go over the top. And so those guys got out and they had 4-wheelers there for them by then and up there. But before then, they couldn't get a 4-wheeler to them. And Tony and me put it in and got out, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the morning. Next morning, they're briefing at 6. Oh, come on. He goes, "Do you realize how much of your cat was hanging off that That ledge.
Stop.
I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
You know, and I says, yeah, that was all thanks to you guys. You can congratulate yourselves on that one, you know. I says, do you think I liked it? But that's what we had to do to get out of there.
Right.
You know, there's fire coming. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And, but there was just some of the stories, you know. I done a lot of fire. Yeah. Woody appreciated what I'd done for him.
Oh, I bet.
You know, I was pretty good. Do you know, he's in the Crick stuff there. Joe Platt. You know Joe?
I've heard that name. Anyway, I think I've ran across him.
Joe was his, he thought sunrise and set on Joe's backside, you know. And, you know, I was on a fire up Catherine Crick at the merry-go-round. Woody sent me up there. And we went, and it was steep, and then we went in this draw, and we were right along a creek there. And there was a lot of fire that year and very little resource. Hmm. Woody says, do whatever you have to do to get this. So I bailed off. It was pretty steep there. Put in a trail, and then I got down there, and I just made a road right into Catherine Creek so they could bring pumpers in at the bottom edge that night. Mm-hmm. Next morning, Joe goes, you know, he says, I don't think Joe could have done that. And I says, I know damn good and well Joe could have done that, Joe. I says, number one, he didn't have the right cat. Number two, he didn't have a good enough operator. And Joe's a great operator. Yeah. I'm not knocking him one bit. He's as good an operator as there was, but it wasn't going to be Joe Pony on it, you know. And they didn't have the experience of handling wood, you know, solid timber and brush, and you got to root it out and know how to do it in an effective manner, you know. And you know Joe, I was on a fire above Haynes, had a D7 with me, and we're going up this ridge, building a pretty good fire trail. It was virgin timber, never been logged. He came up there and he goes, I thought that D7 was doing all the work, and I watched you for an hour. He says, he didn't even do anything. Well, he didn't know anything.
Shot you to the rescue.
You know, that's just, I've done a lot of fire. I've done a lot of initial attack. I could tell stories like Woody had me out here all first, I was for the state because my wife worked for the state clear back in the 80s. And they'd use me, you know. And then went from there to Woody hired me because they had more money and could keep me around longer. And, you know, there's times I'd go on days, I'd be on three different fires and there'd be dozers sitting there, but they wouldn't do the work. I must have been stupid or something. But the thing that really pissed me off the most was they'd send me home because I was too expensive.
But they needed you.
But they needed me. Mm. I mean, I'd give you examples. The canal fire in 89. We were working up Ladd Canyon, and Sarah worked for the state then. We had a black crowd come through about 9:30 in the morning. And, I mean, it lit it up from Medford through Bend through us. Into the Idaho Panhandle and into Montana.
I mean,
it was spooky. We were on the highest peak up Ladd Canyon. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were on top of the world. And that was popping. And one of my friends, they've been friends all my life, was running a loader for me. He was scared to death. I mean, it was popping and you could smell the sulfur. We seen six starts and we put three out. Mm-hmm. And Sarah called me and says, they want your stuff, haul everything you can get. We're going to Wallowa County because it got bombarded. And we put six fires out on Day Ridge and Coon Ridge that night. We moved from Ladd Canyon in the morning to there, and that night we were on nine fires that day.
It's a big day.
That's a long haul.
Anyway, we went to the canal fire. We were working, and we had no E-number. Back then, I might show up just the way I'm dressed and go to a fire.
Right.
You know, there was no protocol. There was no education. Clothes kind of come along. First it was a yellow shirt, and then we had to have green pants. But E-numbers, I can't tell you how many fires I didn't have an E-number. We were up there, and we'd worked for, my father-in-law and me worked for 4 days. I mean, 20-hour days. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we weren't sitting around.
Right.
Stuff was happening. We got there, and the fire grew. And they were going to send us home because we didn't have an E-number. And I threw a pretty...
A respectful fit.
Not respectful, normally. And, you know, but I've had that happen like in 2002 when the Boulevard fire inside the watershed. Paul called me. And He goes, Mark, it's 6 o'clock on a Friday night. I was just getting ready to go to Fossil. My wife's sister was going to get married down there the next day. We got a fire in the watershed. We want you to come in and take care of it. I says, well, I'm just getting home. Let me walk through the shower and I'll throw some clothes on. So we go up there. We get into the fire. It was Tom, my swamper, and me, three of us. Yeah. We get into the fire about, I mean, we get up there midnight with the low boy and the cat, and there's flashing lights and people all over. When we get to the fire, it was down there about 3 miles, and we just went in the dark. And I don't use lights. I usually use a beacon and just follow the beacon. Your eyes will work a lot better because you get the lights and get dust.
Yeah.
You have mm-hmm. no idea where in the hell you're at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. you know. So I don't like lights, you know.
Yeah,
I like them, but I don't like
them. Yeah.
You know, and so I just follow this beacon, and we just went through the timber out through there and got to the fire. And I got it wrapped up just breaking daylight. It was Labor Day weekend. And this big fir tree had a pitch pocket, and it would blow flame out. And we'd chase it around, and it had just instant ignition. Mm. You know, outside the fire line. And so the three of us fought it, and finally about 10 o'clock they showed up. He goes, this dozer isn't leaving. I mean, it shouldn't even been in there. It was in a, you know, restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, you're staying here. So I stayed there 5 days. And the fire was out. They mopped up, and they're trying to figure out who started to figure to hunt her with a cigarette or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they're gridding, they were finding it, and if you've ever been in the watershed, you'd understand it. It's alpine and dead lodge pole this deep, and you know, and alpine likes to burn.
Yeah, right.
And so they're gridding, they kept finding these spot fires. So he says, you're not leaving. Paul says, boy, I'd like to drive that cat one of these days, you know. I said, well, you're welcome to it. It's sitting right there. And they're out in this meadow, just like cross street to that house. There's a meadow, and then there's like a teepee full of dead lodgepole all piled up there. You know, we just kept looking at that. Fifth day, about 2 o'clock, it was just like you flipped a switch, and it was burning. I mean, not just trickling some smoke. It just blew up. Paul took his pack off and started running for the creek for a safety zone.
Oh, my God.
I hopped on and got it worked out. He says, that's why we had you here. And then from there, they started having more fires. Well, they moved me down to the Seeger place. They've set fire camp up there. And, well, I had a grader and some other stuff sitting there, seven and stuff. And I pull in there with the low boy, and there's this big guy sitting there. And he goes, I couldn't make the corner. It was a sharp corner there. And he goes, I says, these pickups got to move. I can't make that corner. And he sits there. He says, what do you mean? I says, I can't. It's too sharp a corner, just like that, you know.
Yeah.
I says, I can't make it. Then pickups got to move. And I says, I doubt if I can make it then. And it was on property that I managed, you know, and those were my equipment, and they'd already moved it. And he was there pretty bristled up. And so finally they moved, and they grumbled, and all they were was chase rigs, you know.
Yeah.
And so I make the corner, and there was an L bolt there, and I cut the sidewall out of both my outside duals on the driver's side. Cutting the gate, and I still pushed the post over on that side with the low boy getting in there. Go over there, and he goes, told that guy, he goes, call up Leshwa and get some tires up here right now. And that guy says, that was operator error. We're not going to do that. I says, you son of a bitch. I took a run at him. I was going to let him have it. I'd been 6 days
right
with no sleep
uh-huh.
and not the best food and anything. And I come a running at him, and Jay jumped on my back and goes, Mark.
Yeah.
He's, you're going to go to jail. I says, it ain't going to be the first time, because 1987 down in Burns, I got the same thing. You know, just people don't know what they're doing or talking,
mm-hmm.
you know. They don't even know what the hell's going on, and they're trying to tell you what to do.
Mm.
You know, so many fires. Like,
doesn't fly with Chachi.
No.
No.
Tony's pretty political. I'm not. But anyway, but back to logging, you know. I mean, I just... We grew, and we got a lot of logging, a lot of big timber, and we logged it from that bigger round to that bigger
round,
you know, and managed.
Yeah.
You know, that was the name of my company, M&S Timber Management Services.
Yeah, it sounds like you lived up to that, for sure.
Yeah, I had good clients.
That's awesome.
You know, it was a good life.
Yeah.
So
it was hard.
Yeah.
But it was good.
So how do we circle back to... what we were talking about before we started is how a bunch of your loggers would bring their kids to work.
Oh, okay. Well, my daughter, I was in a big outfit, but we had a lot of tentacles. You know, I had big dozers. Like, I built golf courses in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Back to what you're saying, we were child friendly. You know, Scott worked for me a lot. He'd bring Roger work for me. Barry bring his two boys. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a daughter, and she'd come all the time with a cousin of hers or a friend. Mm-hmm. You know, and they'd just go off and ride four wheelers. And you know, there was times. The best story is, I got it here. The best story is, our family. My dad started tradition of a 4th of July lamb barbecue because we're Greek. Mm-hmm. Clear back in the 30s at the ranch at Starkey. So we've had it until everybody got old here, maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It stopped, but we had that, and we always went there on the 4th of July. We furnished the lamb and beer, you know, and it got out of hand after a while. You know, it was family and friends, and then there'd be, who's that? You know, and there'd be 400 people there, and they were riding horses and shooting guns and riding motorcycles.
What, in the
and,
Greek festival?
You know, yeah, and it was wild. Then it got out of hand, so we kind of parted it back. Yeah. But anyway,
just
it, was a, it was a 4th of July thing, and Tessa was with her friend Monica, and we were working on the Hall Ranch up, and I was underneath a log loader there, and they were off riding four-wheelers, and the tamarack dust was about that deep. And I was working underneath a log loader there fixing the hydraulic leak, and here they come running down the road. You know, and they're 10 years old, maybe. Eyes about this big around, you know. They go, Dad, this bird with orange eyebrows and its beak went like this flew and landed on the front of my four-wheeler. I go, what? Monica goes, no, Mark, that's true. It did. And so they just banded the four-wheelers come running down the road. And I mean, they're just dirty and they're big eyes. And so I crawl out from under there, and we walk up there, and we had a little house. We've always had a house dog. And went, and there's a lot of turkeys there. And I thought maybe a turkey flew by or something, you know. And anyway, the house dog scared off a bird on the back side of a brush pile there. And I, well, that's that. We go there. Well, it was a, they call them fool grouse when they're mating. Mm-hmm. And they puff up, and they got big red spots in their neck here, and their eyebrows are orange. And I could have reached down and wrung its neck. It wasn't, and, but they said it landed right on her, as she was riding down the road, landed right on the front of the four-wheeler. So that's a pretty good story. But, you know, we had them, and they were with us all the time. And we were doing a project on Dick's had property up McIntyre, too, the one that bought the Seeger place. We were working on an in-stream project. I was working with Mike at MyTrack Construction. And in the summer, Craig was his childhood friend. And he was a school teacher and just had, so it would be the fourth grade, mm-hmm. had Tessa and Monica, and they were there every day. And then Mike was bringing his kids. And there was a guy from the Forest Service, he was an engineer. He was there. And he told Mike, because it was Mike's job, and then I was doing other work, but I was helping mm-hmm. him with my, he needed a big cat to do some work. Anyway, you know, Tess and them would be at lunchtime, be a chattering with Craig there and having fun. And then they'd be riding four-wheelers all over. Of course, she knew that property pretty well. You know, yeah. They're secure. I mean, they're private. Nobody's going to be around, you know.
Right.
This engineer goes, told Mike, he says, these kids shouldn't be here. This is a dangerous situation. You better not be here. And he didn't even know what he was doing. Chuck. And Mike says, Mark, I didn't want to tell you this, but I says, what? Man, I shot right down there, and I says, that guy will be out of there tomorrow. I says, this is private property. We aren't going to put up that BS. He ain't going to tell me what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know, get, and they got him out of there.
Yeah.
And we finished the job without him, you know, because the kids were there, and that's how you learn. Mm-hmm. If you aren't subjected to something, you know, that's the problem with today, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't do this, and you can't do that. They're not subjected to life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's how... You know, yeah, people got hurt and people did die, but most people learned back then, and people still die today and don't learn nothing, mm-hmm. you know, in right. the same process. So, yeah, we always had kids. And we done a job at Wild Horse. A friend of mine bought the timber. We had looked at it 2 years earlier, and it was probably the best patch of private timber I'd ever seen in Northeast Oregon, and I looked at a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it was like coast timber. And the export market was up, and he was from the west side exporting. But there was pine, too, and he didn't know anything about it. And so he talked to me and made the deal with this export company to get the money, and he could have the pine. Well, we sold the pine into John Day for a hellacious, it was big yellow pain, for a hellacious price. And so he made some pretty good money, and I made a lot of money doing the logging job. Mm-hmm. And we were there, and Sarah and the girls were in a camp trailer, and it was in December. It was cold. And I think Tessa was 6 months old. I got a picture of her in the bathtub. Dimitri was two, I think, our other daughter. And, you know, we were there, and finally she goes, "Mark, I'd burn up two generators trying to keep them warm." Yeah. And she goes, "We got to go home. You know, we can't stay here any longer." But, you know, that's just in the summertime up at Dick's. They'd come up and camp, right. You know, because I'd done all the loading in the morning, the first round, and then my nephew took over and ran the loader the rest of the day. But I wanted to be there, you know, in the wintertime. I could plow snow all night and have the roads open when the trucks got there. Mm-hmm. You know, if something broke down, I could have it fixed by the time they got there, like a hose or something. We had to wait for it to come in on freight. And I got into it with Western Equipment when they were here. So I started buying everything out of Pendleton. And one of my truckers was from Pendleton. His wife would go up at 10:30. They'd fly it into Pendleton at 10:40 or something. And she'd go pick it up, put it in the seat, if it wasn't, you know, big, put it in the seat of his truck. And I always loaded him first, and people bitched about it. And I go, "Look, this is the way it's going to be."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he's providing a service here.
Right.
And then I could load, you know, however many trucks we had. And then usually if it's a hose or something, I could have the machine running by the time the crew got there in the morning. You know, I didn't get much sleep. I didn't require much sleep.
Right.
You know, I could live on about 3 or 4 hours.
Still make them like they used to.
Not anymore. You know, I mean, I did, you know, I played poker with a bunch of young guys, and they're all whining. And they always play on Monday night, and I played with the Pinktons and my nephews and that for a year, probably 15 years while I was working. And it'd be Monday night, and we'd play till midnight, 1 o'clock. And I'd usually just go to work from there, you know, and slip in a pickup or, you know, until something. The trucks got there or something. But I no use trying to go to bed. And it, you know, these guys now, I says, "Let's play." "Oh, we got to work tomorrow." I go, "You guys." You're right. They don't make them like they used to.
No.
You know, I played poker on Monday nights out at Cove right now. And there was a guy there, and we were talking about that. And he's wanting to retire, and he's offered his business to two nephews. He said they don't want to work that hard. And he says, "It's very lucrative." And then another guy owned the Union Market, and his son and daughter-in-law took it over. He made him work there for a year to see if they'd like it. He says, "I'm not going to set a trap for you. I mean, it's just like anything."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you got to like it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And set him up for success.
Yeah, you know. So that's the way it was, you know, with kids. I mean, we always had kids around.
That's awesome.
You know, it was business, and we worked hard, but, you know, I grew up in Greek tradition. We're family, you know. So, I don't know. You got one other thing here, I think.
What else we got?
I think you've talked about a lot of
talked about the lows and highs of logging. Let's see what I got there.
I think we got some of that.
Yeah, you gave us some colorful
fight
lows,
you know,
and highs.
Well, the highs, you know, I mean, you're dealing with weather, you're dealing with market, you're dealing with ever-changing rules and laws.
Right.
I mean, you know, I mean, you almost got to be a New York lawyer to keep up with it. You know, I mean, like I said, I've done a lot of stuff, and out at the NRCS out there, I used to do some projects. Cause I was big in water, you know. I believed in these. Grew up on a cattle ranch. The reason, you know, my brother owns up the Grand Run River, and in September, all the cattle are right there. Well, that's where the water's at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All the feed's clear up there. There's no water up there. Well, since then, we remedied that by building ponds, and that's what we'd do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just believe in that, and I wrote this one project for Sherry, has a ranch here west of town, and it was for water. And this Karen Decker goes, "That's the worst written report I've ever seen." I says, "Well, Karen, I didn't know you had to be a New York lawyer, that was more important than the project." I says, "Has the project got any merit?" "Oh, a lot of merit." And I says, Well, what's the big deal? She says, well, you got to realize on the, there's like nine parts, and every, there's nine people, and they only read to one part, so you got to repeat and repeat and go in a different direction, and, you know, and use semantics. And I says,
that's not the way you roll.
No, not at all. Logging is a tough business. I was just talking down at the baseball game today with Mitch. Do you know Mitch?
We do.
Yeah.
She works, well, you used to work with Derek.
Yeah. Yeah. So Derek and I were on the same crew.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Mitch, yeah, we're talking today, you know, he's logging, his dad logged, drove a log truck. Mitch got his logging truck and logging. I was just asking him today how much a log truck makes. You know, I've been out of the loop for a few years.
Right.
And seeing, and he told me, and, you know, I must have overpaid him back in the day compared, you know. I mean, he says, well, if we can get 1,200 to 1,400, we're doing good. You know, I was paying 800 a day in 1992, 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's a lot different.
That's
wild.
You know, I logged on Rodeo Mountain in 94. That was a weird story, too. I went and looked at it, and it was a big job, and Dick decided he didn't want to do any log. We were all geared to go logging on Seeger Place, and he said, I don't. Just last moment, it was 4th of July, and I went down 2 weeks earlier and looked at this job at Rodeo Mountain. And 4th of July, a guy calls me up. He goes, what's it going to take for you to log it? I gave him a price, and it was a pretty dang good price, real good price. And he says, can you start tomorrow or today? Can you start moving equipment today? And I go, no. I said, I've got a family barbecue I'm going to. We jawed back and forth, and this was the day of the fax and all that crap. We finally got a contract signed. Next morning, I went down, and I hauled a piece down, and Scott was down at McDaniels, I was talking about, was down at Fossil, and I went and picked a stroker up. He had a buncher and a stroker. We brought it in, and then we brought in Roger's single grip. Then I brought in a cat and a skidder and a loader and shop truck and stuff. We started, and it was the best job I ever had.
Hmm.
I mean, we put 26 loads a day out for 6 months.
That is...
At a hell of a price. $240 back then, 94, delivered.
How many log trucks did you have?
We had a guy, I can't remember his name. The Pine went to Prineville, and he had 8 trucks, and we used them for that.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy had a forester hired. He owned the Cal Neva Club in Reno, if you're familiar with that.
No.
It's a casino one.
Oh, he owned a casino. Oh.
In the Cal Neva Club in Reno. And anyway, we were there, and he had this quote-unquote forester out of California. Well, we were sending the fur into John Day, and it just, scale wasn't right. I mean, like I says, I understand scale maybe better than any logger in the business.
Hmm.
You know. We scaled for scale at the coast ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I merchandise. I still got it upstairs. It was in a placard that when we're logging, we decide how we're going to cut a log up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a big log, small log, but a big log. We're going to get every dime out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an art to that, for
huh?
sure.
There's I understand it. I understand the scale table very well. Mm-hmm. And I understand the rules very well. And anyway, this guy, so I call up this guy. And Mike Wiedemann got him. He was doing the line logging on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's there, and we're camped out in the woods and on the job. And the crew went to spray every night in a motel there and then come back. And anyway, this guy got going, and I go, look, you're getting screwed, and I'm getting screwed worse. I go, and then he made me mad, and I took off on a tirade. And I was screaming and hollering. I was red-faced. I even had to stop and take a few breaths. Wiedemann was over there just laughing. He says, meet me and John Day at the airport at 1 o'clock tomorrow. So we shoot down there, and I bring Jack Boyd from North Powder Lumber, timber buyer, and Wiedemann, and we go to John Day the next day, and this guy comes in a Learjet with an 18-person entourage. Had the ex-Secretary of Agriculture with him. We're sitting down there. He goes, which one of you gave me the worst ass chewing I've ever had in my life?
Loud and proud. Mark Johnson, reporting for duty.
Yeah, well, I just says, that'll be me. And he goes, Jack, and I says, look, this the scale, and this, I had the scale sheets mm-hmm. of the loads in that. And I says, this is how much we're losing. We're losing 40%. And so we're going there, and we get a talking, and he says, all right, I'll get rid of that guy. Well, come to find out, that guy in the mill were in cahoots. And they turned into a huge lawsuit over it. He says, I am glad. He says, they were going to take us to the cleaners. Because, see, D.R. Johnson was the big logger. They had the mill there at Prairie City, and he had all the loggers. He told them, if you take this job, you'll never log for me again. Well, they were stupid. Because it was a great job, and then D.R. went right out after that.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was a great job. Good money, good timber, you know. And so we had that, and then we ended up taking all the fir to North Powder Lumber, believe it or not. I had a string of trucks there in Empty's name from Prineville. Mm-hmm. And he had 8 trucks, and he hauled the pine. And then the fir went to North Powder Lumber. There was lodgepole in there like this with 3 long logs on it. They didn't even want to log it. This had no value. This kid, see, they did, that mill didn't want it. I go, what do you mean? Roger grew up with Chris' dad when they were doing all the chipping and that.
Yeah.
That's how I got in with Roger. He had had just a shearing for Chris' dad when they were chipping all that lodgepole in this country. And I go, what do you mean? I says, there's probably more money in that than anything, scale-wise.
Yeah.
You know? And the price wasn't that far off from Doug Fir. And so anyway, it turned out to be a very good job.
Thanks.
And it turned out real well. So, it's, you know, just fate happens sometimes, you know.
Right.
We had nothing going on. It was 1st of July and turned it into the best job I ever had. It's, you know, that's what I said, that ebb and flow, you know, it mm-hmm. happens. Talk with Mitch, the guy that he's working for, his dad bunched for George forever. And then he quit. And so George bought that Tiger Cat this year, and then a kid from Wallowa, Dan McDonough. Now. And anyway, his son, Jesse, mm-hmm. cut for me up at Dick's there at the last. Jesse is born 50 years too late. He's trying to, and anyway, I was at Mitch Hall's for him, and, mm-hmm. and they were going to try hauling some wood out on Cricket Flat tomorrow. And Jesse called him. I go, Mitch, tell him you don't want to go. You're drinking too much beer and having fun down here at the baseball game. He's like, who the hell is that? Oh, that's Mark Johnson. He started laughing because Jesse, he's pretty aggressive, mm-hmm. you know, but he's just, you know, there's still a lot of work out there, but it's different.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's like Doug McDaniel, a very big contractor in this area in the 60s and 70s. He was in his first term of dental school. He's from Willow County. In his first term of dental school, there's a physiology class, I think he said, or anatomy, one of the two. And it was a nice sunny day, and all he could think about was deer hunting and logging, and he walked up to the professor, and he says, I'm going home and become a logger. I bet you that guy thought that must be the dumbest son of a bitch in the world. You know, going to be a dentist. And he went on. And Doug was very, very intelligent and a family friend, and he taught me a lot about how to do things right, you know. And he come home, and he started out cutting logs and just asking questions. And he always had a notebook and writing stuff down and awesome. And stuff. And he went around, and if he needed a skidder operator, loader, he heard who the best was. If he was in Burns, he went down to Burns and hired him. Mm-hmm. And he goes, Mark, pay the guys enough and work them 5 days a week, decent equipment, and let them have the weekends. He's these guys that try to work 6 days a week, and that nobody wants to work on Saturday, especially logging. Mm-hmm. You know, he says, let them have their family time and fun time, and pay them a good wage, and you'll be ahead. You'll be ahead in the long run.
Yeah, that's how you keep good people.
Yeah, you got to pay them.
Totally.
You know, you got to pay them. You know, like I said, I was never big, so when I needed trucks, I could always get them. You know, mm-hmm. people says, how can you get the trucks? Because I says, I pay them. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, you take care of your people.
Yeah, you know, I had. 3 jobs where I put out 25 plus loads a day. I'm just one horse outfit.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need trucks to do that. Mm-hmm. That one there we done at Weston there up Wild Horse Creek when the kids were little in the trailer, you know, the pine was going to John Day and the rest was going downriver to Longview. I mean, we needed trucks.
Yeah.
Because we, I think we put 24 or 25 loads a day out there. And that was all hand stuff. We'd done that with 2 log cutters, 3 knot bumpers, and the best loader operator I ever seen in my life. I'd bought a brand new Link Belt 3400 log loader and had it delivered there. I couldn't run it because I was old still, 5-stick Barco and Prentice, you know, and just old school slow hydraulics and everything. And this was a track machine and pretty nice. And I could hardly run it. And I got it up there where the job was. We'd been working already. I mean, when we got there, there was a pine draw and I cut it. And a guy at work for me skidded it, and my nephew ran the loader in the landing, and we put 10 loads a day out, 3 of us. Dang. You know.
That's hard work.
Huh?
That's
you
hard
bet.
Work.
Yeah. With a power saw, you know. Mm-hmm. And anyway, here comes this Indian walking up the road. Shag pants. I had shag pants, but I never wore them hickory shirts. You know, you'd have never known I was a logger. You know, I mean. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, have all the suspenders and
right.
steel and cat. You know, that wasn't part of me. You know, I knew who I was.
Yeah.
You know, and anyway, you come walking up the road. And I said, he's heard you're looking for a loader operator. And I said, well, maybe. I don't know. I said, you ever run one of these? Oh, yeah, in Southeast Alaska. I said, let's see what you can do. He jumped up there and I says, can you be here in the morning? No. He said, I got to give my boss till the end of the week. I'll be here Monday. I says, how much? He told me. I says, that's a little more than I pay, but I says, looks like you know what you're doing. I'll pay you. Hmm. His name was, now I forgot it. Got to talking and forgot it. He taught me more about shovel logging than everybody in this country will ever learn.
Mm.
We went and we had a cat and a skidder skidding into him and the 3 knot bumpers. And a lot of it was big timber. And we were cutting for export, and then the fall down went to North Powder and the pine went to John Day. He could run that, load trucks, cat and skidder bringing drags in, and 3 knot bumpers running around, and nobody was ever in harm's way, and that grapple never even done that. It just... And anyway, below the road, there was some line logging there. It was a county road, and below it, and I was going to bring my little line machine in to do it. We were working 6 days a week. See, I says, don't work, but it was kind of a rush-up job before we got mudded out mm-hmm. in the wintertime. And... he goes, why don't you guys go home on Friday and I'll see what I can do. I says, can you take care of this? And he says, oh, maybe. I preloaded the trucks to John Day. They made 2 trips a day for the pie on Sunday afternoon. So I get there. Here he is. Machine was always greased, fueled, everything taken care of. He's greasing. He'd shovel log that whole slope in those 2 days. 44 loads. And had them sorted. We had to work them up naturally.
Yeah.
But they were there. And it was fairly steep. I said, how'd you do that, Richard? He said, well, that's the way we do it in Southeast Alaska. He says, you just pull a stump and turn it upside down. It's like a road. And you just kept swinging it uphill and then tipped the stump back over and it didn't look too disturbed. And he was very good. But
wow.
He taught me a lot and made me a lot of money.
Mm.
Well, finish his story. That next spring's when we were going to the place. He worked about 2 weeks, turned into drunk Indian. By far the best loader operator I've ever laid eyes on. Finally I go, Richard, I'm going to have to let you go. Well, he didn't like that small wood. That other was big wood, you know.
It was more fun.
Yeah, this is just junk and break. And I mean, literally chunk this big was going on a truck this
yeah.
big around. At the price we were getting. Nothing was staying behind. I think I figured that year I dug 105 loads out of brush piles of the guy that was in there before us. That's how Dick got the ranch. This Riney's daughter was running it. Well, she wasn't running it for Riney.
Yeah.
And she had this fly-by-night in there, and he had just made a horrible mess. And like I'd load first round in the morning if I had time before the crew got there. I'd just start digging in the brush pile. Pope. I figured I got 105 loads out of the brush pile.
Worth it.
70 some dollars a ton. Yeah. I guess it was worth it.
Yeah.
I can't believe that price. You can do the math on that. I can't believe that price.
Huh?
I still can't believe that price.
Well, we just hit everything. It was a jackpot. We hit everything right.
Right.
You know, made a lot of money, you know, that could have went the other way. That's what I was saying. You know, timing's every, that's like in any business, but you know, that's the way logging is. You know, weather, that's like Mitch hadn't been able to work, well, he's going to try and work tomorrow. Rain's coming, what, Thursday?
Yeah.
So it's over again.
Yeah. You know?
But Jesse wanted to get as many loads out as he could get out, you know, with this kind of weather.
Totally.
Yeah.
Huh?
You guys were built different. Yeah.
I never come home. You know, that's like when I was in New Mexico. I come home on our anniversary and something else, and I just stayed there. Same way when I was in Escada. 5 or 6 hour drive to come home and be tired and go back. Because I was preloading on Sundays, you know. And I'd work. Craig's son was rodeoing in high school, so he brought Sarah and the girls down, I think, 2 or 3 times. We went to the zoo and done some things. Went to the Greek restaurant there and that. But, you know, other than that, you might as well work and then come home. You know. And then, you know, like you say, the other thing is, every spring vacation, you know, because I worked a lot. Long hours and a lot of weekends. You know, I've done a lot of mechanic and road building, plowing snow, that type of stuff. And spring vacation, we always went somewhere. You know, and those were usually an adventure.
Oh, I bet.
One year, Sarah says, let's go to San Francisco. I said, okay, get some tickets. So she got tickets into Oakland. The Final Four was there that weekend. We didn't have a motel room or nothing. I get there and had to almost get in a fist fight for the last 2 rent-a-cars.
Oh, my God.
They were all gone. And we got one. And then we went over into San Francisco there. You know, we had no idea where we were going or doing it. And found a room. My daughter wouldn't even sleep. She slept in a chair that first night. She's kind of phobic anyway. And she says, so we had to go hunt a better room up after that. But it turned into a good trip.
Right.
They're better that way.
Yeah, totally.
You know, than being too organized. It must be that way. There's no adventure in it, you know. So
with all those stories, what's some advice you'd give to the next generation of folks?
First thing is not to be afraid to work. If you're afraid to work, don't even give it a shot. You know, it's not going to work. I mean, I've seen too much failure in that. And I'm not going to say anything because they're friends of mine, you know. And I worked with them, and they'd go, and then they'd just hit a wall or something. Lose interest, go broke, you know. And, you know, you just, this is a business you have to work, and you're going to sweat, and you're going to bleed. And if you can't have people that are not willing to sweat and bleed, you shouldn't have them around. You know, that's like, you know, throwing a lot of names out here. I hope you're not going to broadcast this somewhere where everybody's going to hear it. Craig's one of my best friends. You know, they got a business here in town. You know, and he goes, geez, I could pay that and this and that. I go, Craig, the difference between me and you at that time, doing a lot better at it. His son took it over. But you're hiring boys. I'm hiring men. Huge difference.
Yeah.
You can pay a boy $10 an hour. You can't pay a working man $10 an hour.
Right.
You know, you got to pay him accordingly. And I always did. You know, you know, like I said, if I needed trucks, I could get them today.
Right.
You know, just because I was willing to pay for it. Always.
Yeah.
You know, and I knew people that were in the business that, geez, you could have made $50 a day off a truck, you know, which I could have, you know.
But you gotta
probably been another $1 million in my bank account, but what difference was that? At least I can walk down the street and all these guys, you know, we went to the bar here with my daughter here a while back, that we go down to Bud's to have the steak bites when she comes in from Idaho. You know, and this guy's sitting there and he goes, you don't remember me, do you? And I go, I have no idea. You know, I've met so many people over the years, especially truck drivers, hundreds of them. You know, and they might have hauled one load for me, but how can I remember? you know, everything. He says, well, I worked for you clear back when I was still in Wallowa, you know, in the 70s.
But he remembered you. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know. So, you know, it just, you know, that's the first thing. If you want to get in the business, not be afraid to work. And the next thing is, it's a lifestyle, not a job. Mm. You know, I mean, it's definitely a lifestyle. It's not a job. Like my wife says, you liked work too much. You enjoyed your job. I'd go on fire, and it wasn't for the money. It was for the thrill. Because like I say, I could stay at home and make just as much money a lot of times. You know, I didn't want to take a bath at 3 o'clock in the morning in the Imnaha River after running a cat for 22 hours. You know what I'm saying?
Who else does? That
wasn't what I was there for. Yeah. I was there for the thrill. And we had a lot of thrill on that fire. You know?
Certainly.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a different mentality. My brother worked construction all the time. And like he says, he tried logging a little bit. In fact, he drove for Earl Williams back in the day, you know, and it was 18-hour day trucking days, you know.
Yeah.
And on Saturdays, you went down and cleaned your truck. And my brother wasn't into that at all. So he went construction, and, you know, all of his life. And, of course, it was, you know, they were building the freeways back then and making good money, prevailing wage. And, you know, he says, loggers get tough, and they just hump up and work harder.
Mm-hmm.
He says, construction people start whining, get more money. You know, and that's kind of back in the day, when I first started, we were cutting logs up Carson, Washington. And, you know, you went to the bar every night and drank and raised hell. And, you know, it's not that way anymore. It's a business, you know. That's like Doug Mitchell's success when we were talking, oh, you guys are making too much money. And I go, Doug, we bought one machine that cost more than your entire outfit cost.
Yeah.
One machine. And that's down to the typewriter the secretary was typing on.
Mm.
You could pickups and everything. I said, we're buying pickups that cost more than your D8 cat cost.
Yeah.
You know, just to get people to work. You know, I'm out there, John was his best friend. You know, there was years we were buying two new one-ton pickups every year. You know, for the crew. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, we started out running junk and that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get to work. If you can't get to work, you're not making any money and you're spending money on junk.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And, you know, so it just, it's a lifestyle. And like I said, if they're going to get into it, you know, it's kind of like this Mike did over there. You better get your feet wet and kind of understand where you're headed before you dive into it.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse's granddad logged here. My brother cut logs for him in the 50s, Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was born too late, but he's doing all right. He'll do all right. They're still logging out there. I mean, yeah. Chuck, 2 or 3 years ago, jumped me. He was talking to Gary there at Les Schwab, and he says, you want to start logging again? He says, there's a lot of work out there, and we need help. Absolutely not. The number one reason is, couldn't find the help. That was the problem they're having. Can't find the help. You know, how many people you know says in high school, yeah, I think I'll become a logger. There's none. And but it's a different time now, so it's not quite a wear out, but it's still a burnout. I mean, if you're going to load logs, you're going to have to leave town at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, not show up at 9 and whine that's too early, you know. But anyway, I am very fortunate. I've had a lot of trauma. My hands go numb and stuff like that, and I'm stiff, but I'm very fortunate for my age to be able to go and do what I want when I want.
Totally.
You know, for the amount of trauma I've had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've rolled cats, I've rolled skidders, I've rolled pickups, you name it, I've done it. And I'm just pretty lucky. But, you know, if they want to start, the first thing is, you know, I'll say it again, you can't be afraid to work. Even in today's thing, yeah, they got air conditioned cabs and radio and that, but you're still out there and there's bugs and dust and heat and cold and winter and, you know, it's not a whole bucket of roses, but it's just a lifestyle.
Yeah. Well said.
Huh?
Well said.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, and I used to give talks up at the school in a business class, and the thing I told them, I says, Never let money be your driver in life. You'll never be a happy person. Ever. Find something you like and do it and try to be the best you can be. You know, I tried to be the best. You know, I might have not been a production logger year in and year out, but I'm not afraid to go show people what I've done.
Again, we just want to thank you for listening. We really appreciate it as a new podcast starting out. If you feel so inclined, please like, subscribe, leave us a review. It really helps share our podcast other places. If you want to follow us on social media, it's Decades on Dirt Roads Pod on both Facebook and Instagram. And if you want to communicate with us in a different way, you can shoot us an email at decadesondirtroads@gmail.com.